Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. After 20 years or so of studying health and nutrition and consulting with individuals, I'm now convinced that it's possible to treat anything with the use of targeted nutrients. So if you're wondering, no, I don't think you can get all the nutrients you need from a good diet. After all, who decides what a good diet is for you? You're also different from your inherited propensities to your exposures and traumas. You're all unique. And then there's all the numerous pathways and cascades that your body creates all the time without you noticing. They all need raw materials to make the various biochemicals you need to function. So in this modern world of pollution, radiation, and stress, each of us literally burns through nutrients at a rate that our ancestors couldn't have predicted. It's not about just surviving anymore. Join me today for a conversation with pioneer orthomolecular physician Dr. Richard Cunyon about mega nutrition therapy. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. I've been reading about the senses, how they work, and how that affects the art and science of self-care. I'll start in an unexpected place. In his acceptance speech for receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, President Obama sounded to me very much like the political figures of the Vietnam War era. I kept thinking of the horrific statement I heard in my young adulthood, "We had to destroy the village to save it." While in Europe, Mr. Obama will meet with other heads of state to finalize agreements on climate change now being negotiated in Copenhagen. He promotes a strategy that puts little pressure on U.S. industry to adopt necessary changes. In contrast, Mohamed Nasheed, the president of the Maldives, an island nation likely to disappear without those changes, met first with the people outside the negotiating halls who are advocating strong actions. Mr. Obama, the community organizer, sees fit to do otherwise. And back at home, we have the ugly spectacle of health reform legislation gutted of any real help for people in need, and instead must witness its transformation into an income stabilization program for insurance companies, medical providers, pharmaceutical companies, and medical device manufacturers. When running for president, Mr. Obama said that health care is a right, yet seems unable to promote law that enforces that right. These events have alternately angered me and caused me to despair for a better world. Anger is the emotion of the big no. It turns my attention to a fight for survival. Despair, like grief, is the emotion of loss, and loss of hope in particular. It turns my attention to finding my way without the subject of my love, whether person or place. The relevance to the art and science of self-care is at least twofold. First is the mistaken idea that what we experience, what we perceive, what our senses tell us, is something that happens to us. Instead, it is something we do. That sounds very abstract, so let me explain. I remember long ago seeing two illustrations of how sight works. The modern illustration showed light reflected off an object and falling on the retina. The antiquated illustration showed the eye reaching out and grasping the object. The modern notion is coming under serious challenge by neuroscientists, psychologists, linguists, biologists, and philosophers. They argue persuasively that sensory events cannot be isolated to a specific organ's function, nor to a linear sequence of reactions. Instead, what we sense, what we experience, is part of the integrated whole that is our biology. It's a part of who we are, where we are, and what we're doing. For example, in the last few years, I've recognized that when I feel cranky and tired, I'm likely getting sick and should rest. As neuroscientist Antonio Damasio describes it, my senses are picking up what's happening with my body and stimulating my emotional brain to report in, moving my thinking brain to act, or in this case, sleep. Recognition is the second thing that's relevant to self-care. Research last week reported that it takes between 3 to 4 tenths of a second for someone to recognize simple visual stimulus. Not surprisingly, complex stimuli take longer. The experiment flashed images on a computer screen and asked participants to point to the object and identify it. While this was going on, the researchers measured the participants' brain activity using EEG. What interested me was that although it took a little less than half a second to recognize an image, up to that time, participants could successfully point to the image even though they couldn't tell what it was. In other words, they were aware of its presence without recognizing it. This joins a large body of research about how we are engaged with our environment both consciously and mostly unconsciously. That is, sometimes with recognition of what we're experiencing, but mostly, it seems, with simple awareness. An example is a recent experiment in which the frequency of hand washing increased with specific messages on signs at the entrance to bathrooms, even when few people had any recollection of the actual message. To return to the first point about emotions signaling imminent illness, it's something we can learn to recognize, like I did. Indeed, an important element to the art of self-care is just that kind of learning. It's learning to recognize the messages your body is sending. Remembering that what you experience is integrated with who you are, where you are, and what you're doing. Doing better means learning to recognize the messages your feeling brain and thinking brain are presenting to you, and making changes to your circumstances that encourage that learning and the learning that goes on in your unconscious. That perspective works on the large-scale issues as well. Mr. Obama could use some learning experiences and some changes in his circumstances, such as hanging out with a better class of people. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our new book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, which has its own Facebook page. Just search for Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's guest and show, Mega Nutrient Therapy. Our guest is Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N-M-D. He's a nutrition-oriented physician and orthomolecular specialist with 30-plus years of experience in the nutrition medicine field. He pioneered the use of vitamins and minerals in today's medical practice and was a co-founder of the Orthomolecular Health Medicine Society with Dr. Linus Pauling in 1976. Dr. Cunyon has written many books, including Mega Nutrition and Mega Nutrition for Women, with many published articles to his credit. Dr. Cunyon is well known for his contributions in the Townsend Letter, San Francisco Medicine, and other scientific journals and publications. In 1994, he founded the Society for Orthomolecular Health Medicine, OHM, in San Francisco, a large and well-respected professional organization whose mission is to put nutrition first in the practice of medicine. Through his organization, Dr. Cunyon brings together medical doctors and other medical practitioners to discuss current nutritional approaches to treating disease states. In Dr. Cunyon's own medical clinic, he practices a strategy of nutrition, detoxification, and adaptive support that integrates all aspects of modern preventive health care. Welcome back.
Well, hello, Lena. I loved your description of me. It actually makes me feel like a person. It was very well done.
You seem very much like a person to me, even more kind of than that. I want to mention also before we get thickly into this interview that the OHM Society, which has a website at ohmsociety.com, has a yearly winter professional meeting that's open to the public. You can go to ohmsociety.com and click on the link for future meetings, or just click on the picture of the Golden Gate Bridge and it'll roll over to the information about the year's meetings. I wanted to start this.
Actually, we receive email at yahoo.com, ohmsociety at yahoo.com.
If they want to email you, but if they want to just go to the website,
right. Okay.
Then it's, I discovered by doing this, actually.
Yeah, I should have known better than you.
Yeah, I looked at it, and right. It indeed is ohmsociety.com.
Well done.
The W's. So, mega vitamin therapy, one of the things we talked about is that it's unfortunate that the name mega vitamin causes people to be afraid that actually it's vitamin therapy, but maybe you can, like, bring people up to date, bring the listeners up to date about the history, how long this has been going on, this idea of using vitamins as therapy, the history of it a bit.
The history of vitamins, for sure, goes back to the ancient days where nutrient-rich foods and mineral substances were used to create a compound called theriac, from which our present word therapy derives. In fact, one of the favorite ingredients of theriac was, in all cases, they included snake. Thought you'd be interested in that because the history of medicine traces back then to snake as a therapeutic ingredient. And snake oil in the old days was considered good stuff. In fact, I found myself written up in Scientific American a couple of years ago over an article I wrote after I had snake oil analyzed, not only snake oil from Chinatown, but snake oil I got from rattlesnakes. One was a desert rattlesnake, the other a mountain rattlesnake. And sure enough, the Chinese snake oil was from sea snakes from the ocean. These came out with the highest level of eicosapentaenoic acid shortcut called EPA. They have that
long, at 20%. Long chain omega-3 fatty acids, the stuff you get in fish oil.
And it's an essential fatty acid. Your body has to have it or things go wrong for sure. Mm. And so theriac always had omega-3s in it. Isn't that fascinating? And that's what they wrapped around the caduceus that is the present-day symbol of medicine.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that was a story there as to how the medical profession felt to have that flashed in their consciousness. Because, of course, it means that snake oil is really an injustice to natural medicine, which relies heavily on natural substances that belong in the body, and that Linus Pauling gave a new name just to make impact. He called them orthomolecules. But maybe natural molecules would be quite good, and I suppose we could also say these molecules obey the physiology, the physiological needs of everybody's body. They're universal. So what does that have to do with megavitamins? Well, first, vitamins had to get discovered. James Lind did it in about 1547. I think it was 1747. I may be getting mixed up my centuries, which goes to show you. But it took till about 1800 before the Admiralty admitted that he had proved his point when he cured scurvy, which was a dread disease amongst the maritime people who would have to leave their source of food on shore. And by the time they were 6 weeks at sea, the casualties were beginning to show up with severe infections, particularly dental infections. Their teeth would fall out, and then their old scars would disintegrate as their flesh began to become vulnerable to every kind of, infection and just plain disintegration. A picture that looked, in fact, very much like some of the patients with HIV/AIDS today. Mm-hmm. This was vitamin C. Immune deficiency.
And it might be worth mentioning that human beings and other domesticated animals no longer make vitamin C in their bodies, but wild animals do.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yes, there's only a handful of species that don't make it, and that's another story. But the point is, vitamin C then was discovered in fruits and, to some extent, vegetables. In fact, the French had discovered it in pine needles going way back then into the earliest days
and
of the
sauerkraut.
Of America.
Sauerkraut.
And the Europeans, of course, had it preserved as sauerkraut, right? You are. Lind actually took oranges and kind of dehydrated them and boiled them down to a paste. And they didn't just have limes. The real lucky guys had the full orange all distilled down into its essence as an orange pulp or orange whatever. But it was, in a way, the first vitamin pill. That's why I mentioned it. That way back in the 18th century, the first vitamin pills, concentrated vitamin C and bioflavonoids, were made available to the sailors by James Lind. But then you go for the next big development to about 1911 when Kazimierz Funk, a Polish biochemist, a much happier guy than his name would suggest, he wasn't in a funk all the time, but Kazimierz Funk coined the name vitamin as a contraction of vital and amine. And, of course, he thought that the chemical structure of these precious substances was going to be like an amino acid. And he was responding to the sulfur, particularly in vitamin B1, which was under heavy-duty study at that time, which is a thiamine. It has some sulfur and, I think, some nitrogen in it somewhere to get – or maybe I'm wrong about that. I'm posing a question to myself as I speak. But in any case, it was mistaken for an amino at the time, and it turned out to be not an amino, but rather a new substance, and that was the thiamine. It's a rather complex molecule. I won't attempt to describe it, especially since I've already fumbled. But at least you can see that that's a long time between discovering that there was something in food that people had to have other than just calories or just that was life-giving. And it turned out they could take away the carbohydrate part or the protein part or the fat part. And after the calories were gone, what was left were these little molecular, small molecule substances that we call micronutrients, as opposed to the macronutrients, the big nutrients such as carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. These micronutrients have had about a century now of very active research. Only a century. Think about that. The idea of vitamins is only 100 years old. Up until then, doctors were all enthralled with the idea of germs, that germs were the cause of illness. The microscope had something to do with it because you could see the germs. And you can't see vitamins until you get into an electron microscope, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Or the germ theory took a hold, especially with Pasteur and the studies of the fermentation process for wine in France, because they had a lot of money behind the research
as usual.
And industry. And then, of course, you got into the frenzy of studies of individual organisms around the turn of the century with Paul Ehrlich, Koch, and others who set forth the principles of diagnosing and proving etiology, the causes of infectious disease. But what to do with these persnickety new molecules called vitamins? Wow. Well, the first 60 years after, or 50 years anyway, till about 1947, I think it was, when the last of the major vitamins was actually spelled out chemically, and that was vitamin B12. In the intervening 50 years, all the myriad, over a dozen molecules, had to be discovered, researched, identified, and the syndromes, the clinical syndromes of deficiency, had to be verified. And therein lies another important concept, that vitamins were the first half of the century, were believed to, of the 20th century, were believed to be important because when they weren't there, you had a deficiency disease. And that was a big concept because up until that time, everyone was looking for disease to be caused by something that was there, namely germs. So this was an important and historic, really, advance in civilization and in the common, shall we say, the consensus that we all had first in the 19th century that we had diseases caused by germs, and then the 20th century that we might have diseases caused by, or we do have diseases caused by the absence of vitamins. And then the smug governmental point of view, which was that by putting a few vitamins into food, that we had ended all deficiency disease, and so vitamins, therefore, were no longer important as of 1940. Wow. So if you want the history, then you see the 60 years or 70 years since then, we're reproving that vitamins are important. And sometimes when you don't get benefits at a small amount, you better try a large amount.
There you go.
And there's where megavitamins comes in.
Wow.
And so when I was a boy in medical school back in the 1950s, I have to admit, I lost interest in nutrition just like everybody else because, gosh, the government, Big Brother, was taking care of us. It was all there in the enriched food. I was so impatient that I walked out on a lecture on nutrition. I was a third-year medical student, or I tried to walk out, actually. My good friends held me down, literally. I won't tell that story right now, but suffice it to say, I was reflecting an attitude that I had picked up in medical school, that all that stuff wasn't important.
Let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and that is Richard Cunyon, MD, who has just given us a very succinct and really beautiful explanation of the history of vitamins, their discovery, and their use beyond nutrition deficiency diseases. So, boy, that was great. I'm glad we have that recorded. So it starts this issue of beginning to understand that there were environmental that the environment was damaging our DNA. The beginning hints of that, I think, begin to be noticeable with the work of Abram Hoffer and schizophrenia, where he begins to note that people may have DNA variants and DNA damage that's causing extreme symptoms, in this case psychosis. So that's around 1952.
Well, that's exactly right. It was 1952 that Hoffer and Osmond and Smithies published their landmark study on patients in a hospital, which they were all on the staff together, in Saskatchewan, Canada. And Hoffer was chief of research there, a very qualified genius with a MD on the one hand, but also a PhD in biochemistry on the other. It's often forgotten he had a double doctorate and was research trained. In any case, they performed the first, really first-rate study of biological psychiatry, in which they used what is in a clinical study using patients who are grouped into one group where they are identified as the recipient of the treatment, and another group where they are they're not identified. Actually, you have a treatment group and a non-treatment group, but neither is identified. Nobody knows who's getting the vitamin and who's not. That's the point. It's a blind study, and the patient doesn't know and the doctor doesn't know, so it's a double blind study. And it was the first in psychiatry. Now that's pretty impressive. Maybe because it was the first is the reason it was too far ahead of its time. It wasn't believed.
Right. Right.
So they did it again in 1956, 4 years later with a larger group and a better control. And the treatment group got vitamin B3, which is niacin, and they got vitamin B6, which is pyridoxin, and they got vitamin C. And I never understood how when I was first hearing about these things, I was an old dyed-in-the-wool, conventionally trained guy, and I couldn't understand why they would use more than one thing. How could you tell? Well, it turns out since then we know that niacin in large doses interferes with vitamin B6. It prevents it from being activated into its phosphorylated form, meaning it has a phosphorus pyridoxal phosphate, or vitamin B6 phosphate, is not properly formed in the presence of large doses of niacin. So they didn't know that, but they knew there was some adverse going on when they put the niacin in all by itself. And then the vitamin C, I'm not sure why the heck they put that there. You know, sorry to say Dr. Hoffer died last year, mm-hmm. And now that I think of it, boy, would I have loved to have asked him that question. Why vitamin C? Well, this was before Linus Pauling came along. This was 10 years before Linus Pauling, that they were already using ascorbate as an adjunct in treating schizophrenia successfully. Now, looking back on it, I would give you an answer, if I might digress sideways just for a minute, because you wanted to hear
Please.
A little about this.
Please.
Vitamin C treats lead poisoning. Vitamin C becomes oxalate, which is a powerful chelating agent, binds and helps excrete lead. And in the 1950s, the United States of America was severely poisoned by lead. Every automobile exhaust was pouring it out. Toothpaste tubes had lead. Baby cans, baby formulas, you were getting lead poisoning. It was astounding. So the vitamin C was especially valuable in the 1950s and 60s. In fact, well up into the 70s, before the Lead Paint Control Act was passed by Congress, which removed lead from most of our gasoline and from the indoor paints. But back then, lead poisoning was really big news. And that sort of thing. Vitamin C is so powerful a lead detoxifier that Carl Pfeiffer ran a study just using a couple grams a day of vitamin C. And sure enough, people in a battery plant who otherwise were poisoned were able to be symptom-free and continue working in the battery plant. It was an astounding demonstration. It was so good, I didn't believe it. But I do now, because we see it all the time, that our vitamin C does accentuate or enhance detoxification. And so and by the way, we're talking megavitamins. It doesn't work. Vitamin C doesn't work at a little RDA level of 60 milligrams. It requires at least 20 times that.
And being repleted throughout the day.
Well, maybe that helps, but it'll work even if it's just twice a day.
Twice a day is enough.
Yeah, multiply through the day definitely has an impact,
but at least
twice a day, you bet.
Yeah. But not. But isn't it important to do it more than once? I mean, isn't it important to replete it again at some point, at least twice?
Well, it depends on what you're treating and who you're treating, because
okay.
It's all interactive.
I thought it got used up. I mean, there was that wonderful piece of research where they tested firefighters. They loaded them up with 10,000 milligrams, 10 grams of vitamin C, and sent them out to fight a fire. And 2 hours later, they came back and tested their levels, and there wasn't a bit of vitamin C left in their system.
Used it all up.
Stress, yeah.
But
so
did they test the levels in the serum, or did they test them in the reserve?
Yeah.
They're inside the white blood cells.
Uh-huh. So it wouldn't
and
be showing.
So your immune system will still function, even though you won't be the antioxidant function may be shot. But hey, you're talking about a super. A mega toxic situation too, And there, yes, you bet, extra doses are very helpful.
I guess what I'm trying to do is just, a lot of people when they come to see me are taking a small dose of vitamin C once, and what I understand about vitamin C is that it needs either more vitamin C or other antioxidants to help donate electrons to it as it gets damaged itself by giving up its electrons, doing its job. So I always tell people at least twice a day, don't take it just once a day. I get that you can clinically use it maybe once a day, but I think really realistically people ought to consider doing it at least twice a day.
Well, I agree with you on that and do so myself.
Yeah.
So I don't want to cheat our audience.
No, I just wanted... I mean,
by letting them think that there's an easy way.
Right, exactly.
But it also depends on what system you're measuring, because
sure.
After all, it's used for many purposes in the body. It may be that... And nobody's done the work to prove all this stuff, but one thing that is proved, for example, is that if you have heart attack conditions, that's pretty important. If your blood vessels are going into a spasm, which will cut the blood flow down by 80-90%, that's pretty serious business. And that can happen just by eating. If you overeat animal proteins, which are high in an amino acid called methionine, an essential amino acid, it's something you have to eat, but if you overeat it, it becomes unhealthy.
You're talking about like people who eat over 8 ounces at a sitting.
That's right.
Right.
And because I think it's 100 grams, which is 3 ounces, has about 600 milligrams of methionine in it. But then you get to 8 or 10, you're already up to a gram of methionine.
Right.
When you feed that to people as a test dose, which I do in my practice, at at least 1.5 grams, it's about what you get at a big Thanksgiving or other kind of feast, there is the risk for some people, not all, but some people, about 20%, 1 in 5, have the risk that their homocysteine, used-up methionine, becomes a waste product called homocysteine, and the homocysteine attacks the blood vessels.
Right.
It's very reactive.
Right.
And there'll be a period of a few hours, in fact, over 4 hours, where the blood homocysteine is unhealthy, so high that it will cause the blood vessels, even in healthy people,
mm-hmm.
to shrink down, healthy young people,
mm-hmm.
to shrink down 85%. That's a well-designed research study by Dr. Chambers.
Right.
And that was a very convincing demonstration of the bad side. The good side was that if they took 500 milligrams of vitamin C beforehand, the blood vessels still closed down the same. But if they took 1,000 milligrams beforehand, they were protected. Instead of a 85% drop in flow, they had only a 30%. It was
right.
still something, but it wasn't as bad.
Right.
Now, to me, that was probably the most important demonstration of a quantifiable power of a mega dose. And they even went so far as to show that 500 milligrams weren't enough. 1,000 milligrams was in their dozen or so young people who were avowedly healthy young people. Since then, by the way, the study has been repeated by others.
Yes.
And it's usually they get the same result.
And that's just vitamin C, and we know there are other vitamins. I don't want you to respond yet.
I gotcha.
But no, it's fine. I want you to keep going, but we're getting close to need to take a break. But there are other vitamins that we're going to discuss that also protect the body from high homocysteine. So it's very easy to, I mean, not that you should be eating, you know, a pound of meat at a sitting. It's disgusting. You shouldn't do that, and it is dangerous. But what I was just going to go back to very quickly before taking a break is the fact that what we understand now from Hoffer's work using niacin and vitamin C is that psychosis is often caused by some exposure to a heavy metal or some pollution that's damaging the brain. So one of the things we're learning from that research is not only that vitamins can be used to treat psychotic episodes in people, but that the origins of the psychosis is also from brain damage from pollution.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the other thing we learned.
And we should also know that vitamin B3 does not work only as a vitamin, because it also works by binding to LDL, and it lowers LPA, and it lowers LDL
yes.
to some extent.
Yes.
And in so doing, it becomes an anticoagulant. Blood flow is better. So, and I've had the pleasure of treating schizophrenic patients with anticoagulants, and they recover without tranquilizers, sometimes in a matter of minutes.
Right.
By minutes, I mean less than an hour.
Right. We need to take just a brief musical break and then come back to this interview. You're listening to an interview with Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N-M-D. We're talking about mega vitamin therapy. I'm Lena Berman. This is your own health and fitness. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
Your molecular structure is really something fine. A first-rate example of functional design. Those cosmic undulations are steady coming through. Your molecular structure, baby. Your cellular organization is really something choice. Electromagnetism about to make me lose my voice. Got all my circuits open, my system's reading gold. Your cellular organization, baby, stop the show.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, on the phone today with Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N. We're discussing mega vitamin therapy. I want to just remind you that the OHM Society, which Richard is the president of, has yearly meetings in the winter. You can go to OHMSociety.com and click on the future meeting link or on the Golden Gate Bridge. And you can, if you don't have a computer, you can also call directly at 415, and I don't have it in front of me. Do you have it, Richard?
415-922-6462.
And we'll put that on our website as well. There's also information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our book, our practice, our archive of almost 600 shows. Access to CD copies. It'll also list our book signing appearances and all that and more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. We have a Facebook page, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, for our book, and our information number 707-874-2772. So, wow, this is amazing stuff. Now, niacin is... that isn't for everyone. It works in certain circumstances, but it has a downside to it. So can you be a little bit specific about the types of places where it really works for people? Because my understanding also is that it works for certain clotting factors and not all of them.
Well, that's true. But I think you're asking about the downside. And for most people, the downside of niacin is that it has a very strong effect on inflammatory substances in the body. It activates them. And particularly prostaglandin chemistry, the prostaglandins are derived from fats. Every cell in the body has some fats in the membrane. Niacin encourages the cells to let go of those fats, and as they're circulating around, they become irritants, and they dilate the blood vessels. There's a specific, for those of the scientific bent in the audience, there's a specific prostaglandin called prostaglandin D2, which has actually been identified as the transmitter of this effect of niacin. The prostaglandin D2 levels rise immediately and to a high level in skin and in many other organs of the body, particularly where there's also some inflammatory business going on. It'll identify where your aches and pains are because they get hot. In any case, at least that's a clinical observation I've noticed, in any case, people don't like that hot, flushed feeling sometimes. On the other hand, there's a whole other group that loves it. People that take the niacin specifically to enjoy that warm sensation that they get when the niacin is doing its thing. Now, the amount of niacin to get that flush reaction is not even necessarily mega. It's about a 5 times normal intake per day. That is, 20 milligrams per day would be a usual RDA level of niacin. And here we're using 100 milligrams, and there's a flush that lasts maybe anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, sometimes rarely more. But incidentally, with those who are already suffering from chronic inflammatory disorders, including schizophrenic-type dementias or mental illnesses, very often the flush reaction just doesn't occur. And maybe that's one of the reasons why Hoffer was able to work with niacin so well. The schizophrenic patients weren't complaining. But if you've got a patient who's not as inflammatory and not already spent on their inflammatory responses, in other words, someone who's in the more normal category for the inflammatory response, there the niacin flush at the doses that Hoffer and others of us in the orthomolecular field have used, the doses up into the 3 grams a day category. And by the way, cardiologists are using it for that dose also because it lowers cholesterol very reliably, and that's been a goal of preventive cardiology, as you well know.
Yeah, but what about the effect on your liver of high doses?
Well, the high doses can be inflammatory then in the liver as well, particularly in people who are very low. They're already depleted in their glutathione, the antioxidant of the liver. And so
alcoholics and people who have used drugs.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The unhealthier you are physically.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, the schizophrenics didn't fall into that category, mm-hmm. and they didn't inflame that much anyway.
But it's not good for autistics.
They didn't have the flush.
Right, but it's not good for autistic people.
Well, they will be, I think, disturbed by it more than anything else. So it's the dose has to be attenuated or given a time-release form, particularly as niacin combined with inositol, in which it's called NiaSafe. That's the trade name for it. It's a good product. A little more expensive, but it's also obviates that problem.
And lastly,
there are some people who need the niacin experience, and pre-treatment with vitamin E and particularly with aspirin will reduce that or even erase that response. In fact, I published on that first back in 1973. If you can imagine, I was the guy that discovered that response, and that it was something that would make niacin more usable, more useful.
Some people get terrible belly aches from niacin, too, so it's going to be very individual for people. All I'm trying to do is not sell niacin as something that's for everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's really good if you have actually had a heart panel done and you've discovered you have lipoprotein A. It's quite good for that. So it's good for certain things.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And, of course, the N-acetylcysteine is another, it's kind of mm-hmm. a megadose amino acid. To use the N-acetylcysteine is also quite helpful, drops the LPA into more safe territory where it's less likely to cause unwanted clots.
That's if you actually have LPA. And
kelp will do it, too. You need a lot of it. Maybe a teaspoon or two of kelp will lower LPA successfully. It's quite comforting to know that.
That's good to know. Yeah, you might want to ease up on your other sources of iodine so you don't blow your thyroid out.
Well, right. Although if it's adverse to the thyroid, it usually means you've got too much fluoride or PCB or some
could
other
be.
Ferritin in there, too.
Yeah, could be. Although my understanding is really high doses of iodine kind of, you know, that's what they used to use to kill the thyroid in hyperthyroid conditions in the past.
Well, they're using radioactive iodine.
Now, I know what they're doing now, but I think in the past, they literally used to just load people up with too much iodine. I thought that would sort of stymie or paralyze the thyroid if you overdosed.
Well, if you want a megadose mineral to lower the thyroid, you do it with fluoride. The fluoride in water
thought.
And elsewhere is like that peeve, as you know. We don't want to go there just now.
No, we don't want to do it. No, we don't.
Know that these megadoses operate in minerals as well as in vitamins, and that they're even more delicate in minerals. You've got to be very careful to know what you're doing in minerals because
they
can cause fatality.
I don't want someone who's just been diagnosed with Graves' disease to go out and dose themselves with thyroid.
Fluoride. But nevertheless, you look at a cattle herd, and they're getting fluoridated water, and they get goiters and that sort of thing.
Oh.
We're getting it from PCBs and other halogenated pesticide residues and other kinds of toxic elements. So don't blame it all on, is what I'm saying, we shouldn't blame it all on this or that when it's a total toxic picture of our background individual exposures to pollutants.
Let's talk about folates.
Well, now, folate's a very important thing to recognize. I know I resisted appreciating folates for a long time because I didn't think it was possible that the government would deny us an essential vitamin and that they were protecting us by keeping the level down to 0.1. So I didn't go into folates, even after one of my patients, a schizophrenic, a psychotic gal with hallucinations and delusions, told me that she cured herself with folic acid. Now, you might say that's a delusion because I just described her.
I'm having the same delusion about myself.
But the fact is, she took her folic acid, just plain old folic acid. She took it up to 75 milligrams a day, and She was able to, she recovered, period.
Wow,
she
but that's,
to brag about it.
Usually it's in micrograms, so 75 milligrams.
She's a social worker from Berkeley. She published an article about herself in the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine, of which I was at the time on the editorial board. And we were very welcoming that remarkable experience, because it tells you not only that there's a lot we, at the time especially, did not know about folic acid, but also how important it is to listen to our patients, to take them seriously, that their observations are usually very right on. And in this case, I didn't listen at the time, I didn't forget it either. I just didn't understand it until I began to study homocysteine in earnest about 15 years ago, and especially relative to autistic children. I was the first pointing in that direction of the methylation pathways, because I thought I was seeing about half of my autistic kids when I was tested for homocysteine. They were up over the line of toxic effect. And I didn't believe it enough to publish it. Instead, I retrenched and started studying more, and that's what made it obvious. Homocysteine is that intermediate state of methionine. Methionine lets go of a carbon atom that we give it a special name, the methyl carbon. And in so doing, methionine now is left without an insulator, shall we say, on its hind end, and it's got sparks flying. And so that residual that we call homocysteine sticks to things, and it binds things. It'll, for example, it'll bind to itself. You got a dimer called homocysteine instead of homocysteine. Again, I'm trying to confuse you people on purpose, just to let you know this isn't easy stuff. You got to actually learn a little vocabulary to appreciate it. But the gist of it is that it can activate inflammation in the wall of the blood vessels of the body, so it causes spasm, and it can make the platelets, the clotting cells circulating in the blood, stick to those walls so that it provokes actual clotting. And at the same time, it can grab, it's the most powerful chelator or chemical binder of the copper residues that are floating around. Some of them are stuck to vitamin C, so it changes the nature of vitamin C. It changes the relationship of the clotting factors. It changes the inflammatory state of the blood vessel wall. Wow. No wonder that it is a well-recognized independent cause of clotting in the blood vessels of the legs, the heart, and the brain.
And it's
fact,
so simple
when you
look
to at
fix.
In bad cases, you'll find every organ in the body, including the bones and the pancreas, are also affected by this clotting phenomenon. And worst of all, the pancreas is the first organ hit, which accounts for most people of why they're constipated or why they have gas or why they don't digest well or why they get bloated after a meal, that they actually have a folic acid problem that is going to always affect not only folic acid, but the whole system that we call methylation. The methyl carbon has to do its job. If it fails to do its job, every cell in your body, every organ in your body, every tissue in your body will know about it before long. And by that, I mean within a matter of hours.
And since folic acid and B6 and B12 are all part of this little cocktail, having niacin kick B6 out sounds problematic to me. How would it be? What would the actions be that wouldn't be happening?
Well, exactly. Niacin raises homocysteine.
Aha.
That's the downside.
Ooh.
But on the other hand, niacin then is becomes niacin amide. Niacin loses a hydrogen that's replaced by a floating ammonia, so it detoxifies ammonia. It also, in the process, on the way out the kidney, picks up a methyl group, and so it becomes methyl nicotinamide, and that is also called trigonoline, and it turns out that this can reabsorb, and it's also, while it's circulating, acting as a natural sedative of its own, and a neuroregenerative agent, and an anti-cancer agent, all three in one.
Wait, now we're talking about niacin?
Niacin, yeah.
Okay,
so
what about
B6? Downside is it screws up B6, but the upside is it does all this other good stuff, not to mention the clotting, the anti-clotting effect by taming LDL and LPA in the first place. So, wow.
So, but how can you counter that effect? Because B6 is terribly important with this whole methylation thing.
It doesn't destroy B6 completely.
So you take extra B6.
But I will say this. B6 is a very vulnerable point and needs megadosing to some extent in its own right, simply because when we test people that are going through my practice, and also through, I've talked to the laboratory, others who are ordering the B6 through its active form, which is called erythrocyte glutamic oxalate transaminase.
Easy for you to say.
EGOT, which is a liver enzyme. When that EGOT is not saturated, is not functioning properly, that reflects B6 deficiency. Mm. We're seeing that in about half of the patients we send through. It's the most common vitamin deficiency out there. So obviously, by that token, at least amongst patients seeing orthomolecular doctors who are looking at nutrients in a scientific way, we find that the B6 problems are right up there at the top of the list. And sure, some of the people therefore taking niacin will be particularly vulnerable, and we have to watch out for it. Now, how to treat that? Well, that's sometimes the way to treat it is just more B6. So you get up not to the 1 milligram dose, which is RDA, or 1.5, which is RDA, but you get up to the 10, 20, or 100 milligram dose of the pyridoxine, which is a better bet. Some of your people will have heard of pyridoxal phosphate, pyridoxal 5-phosphate, officially. And they'll say, well, gee, doesn't that work? Can I take that? And the answer is, yeah, if you can get it intravenous. I haven't been able to get it.
Yeah, no, that's no, they don't know what you're talking about, I guarantee you.
Well, the B6 in its active form
it's okay.
is broken down by the stomach acid. Maybe if we learn to give it with bicarbonate, it might work. If we could neutralize the stomach acid, we could get the B6 to absorb as a phosphate. But so far, I haven't seen anybody prove it, let's put it that way.
Well, but it sounds like the state of the gut is important in terms of its correct utilization. Let me just say, this is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N-M-D. Every year, the Orthomolecular Health Medicine Society has a meeting, and you can go to the website ohmsociety.com. If you want to email them, you can go to ohmsociety@yahoo.com. No, ohmsocietysf@yahoo.com would be the email. We'll put it on our website. And if you go to the website, ohmsociety.com, just click on Future Meeting or on the Golden Gate Bridge, and you'll see the information. And we're discussing mega vitamin therapy. I want to not run out of time and not talk about B12. Because it's so important. And I always have people come in and say, well, I was tested and it tested high. And you explained to me that it's very difficult to test B12, which is what I thought.
Exactly.
But it's terribly important. Why don't you talk about its importance before we talk about that? I mean, I think it's enough to say it's very hard to test, so don't worry about that. But talk about its functions.
The importance, in my mind, is that B12 and folic acid in particular, but also vitamin A, retinol, not the carotene, not the vegetable form. The active form of vitamin A is retinol.
Fish oil.
And, well, it's in fish oil, but it's...
No, but I mean, when you buy it in the natural form, it's generally extracted from fish.
Okay, yeah. Well...
I'm just saying, when you get natural vitamin A in the store, it says from fish.
That's true.
There is a synthetic form, but I think we're talking about the natural.
Well, there's a transport form. What you're already getting into, as we both know so well, Lena, is
too much chemistry.
Vitamins have a lot to do with eating. That's for sure. That's the part people.
No, I was just saying that when people
the vitamins have to be they have to be swallowed. They have to go through your body. They got to be prepared. Absorbed. They have to cross the gut. They got to get into the blood. They got to go to the liver. They got to get proteinized. They got to go from there through your circulation. They get to the cells. They have other proteins there that transport and regulate the traffic going in and out of every cell.
And
a lot can go wrong. That's right. And a lot goes right, thank God. If it weren't tightly regulated, we wouldn't be alive.
All I was trying to say is that if people go to the store and they want to buy vitamin A and they don't want it to be beta carotene, they want it to be vitamin A, sometimes what you'll find when you look on the package, on the ingredients, it'll say it's derived from fish oil.
The sources are very important.
Yes.
It's just that if they say vegetarian source vitamin A, it's always carotene, because vitamin A is created, Mother Nature has created an enzyme that oxidizes the carotene, and it splits into two pieces, each of which is a active retinol.
Right, and it won't. Beta carotene doesn't always convert, especially with people with thyroid problems.
That's right, and zinc gets into the act. Also.
Yeah, you need zinc. Anyway, back to B12.
Well, that was. I'm out of breath already.
Well, you're working really hard.
But the B12 goes with the folic acid. They work as a team. When you talk about the one, you're almost always talking about the other, at least in part. Now, where they part, It all has to do with a pathway of passing a methyl group, a single carbon atom that's been prepared for use in the body. So it's an active carbon. And the final transfer of that carbon is through a product called SAM, or S-adenosyl methionine. And I won't explain all of that, what that is, at the rest of our time there. But rather, just to understand, SAMI, which you see at the health food store, is an important carrier for this carbon atom that wants to get into your body, especially it gets into the liver, where it helps the liver create other substances that are used by the body, particularly choline, which is a sort of a fatty substance that is used for many survival elements in the body, and it's now recognized as an essential. Choline has finally gotten how much you're supposed to get every day. I mean, the government authorities, in fact, now respect it so much that they gave it, now I think it was 350 milligrams a day was the RDA for choline. In any case, the B12, you can eat these things to be sure, but your body relies on them literally second to second, minute to minute, and at the most hour to hour. And you can't be eating second to second, minute to minute, and hour to hour. So your body has to make some of this stuff, or at least store it and be able to circulate it. And so the body can make choline. It's one of the biggest items on the agenda for the methylation pathway. In fact, the one and two, the that methyl carbon, the two most, shall we say, numerous products, they make up 70 to 80% of all the methylated products in the body, are phosphatidylcholine, or choline for short, and
It's in egg yolks.
Well, that's right.
And then carnitine.
Very good. Yeah. Exactly. And so carnitine and choline are, in terms of quantity, the big players out of methylation. But there are, it turns out there are about 300 to 400 others, including neurotransmitters, including regulators that regulate cell division, regulators that regulate energy metabolism, regulators that actually determine how much carnitine and how much coenzyme Q, both of these essential stuff that you go pay high, you can pay a lot of money for them at the health food store, but if you're getting your methylation to work, and that requires folic acid and B12 to be active, if you can do that, you can save a lot of money at the health food store. How's that for a sales pitch?
Well, you know, but one thing I'm getting as I'm listening to you is that, you know, I think I know my audience well enough from their contact with me that they're sitting down right now and they're writing down a few nutrient names and they're going to run to the store and they're going to buy specific individual nutrients that we've talked about because it's like they got this blanket message that it's good. I'm not saying everybody will do this, but I want to remind people that when you first of all, what we're saying is that there are specific conditions and symptoms that would indicate using high doses of these. And people can, as that woman who wrote the paper, can sometimes figure out this stuff on their own, but it's pretty complex and it usually helps to have some help with it. But aside from that, if you do introduce some of these materials in, it's always good to start a little bit slowly and build up to see what your reaction is going to be because everybody's very different. But also, it would be prudent, unless there's some reason why you can't take a multivitamin, to take this with a multivitamin because there are all kinds of other micronutrients like minerals that need to be balanced to make all of this work too. And you want all the fat-soluble antioxidants, A and then E and then D. And then there's vitamin K, which is astonishing stuff. Do you want to take off on that for a minute? We've only got about about 5 minutes.
All right, let's finish the book with B12 quickly here. In less than a minute, I would like to add, B12 is known to increase in its requirements with age, for various reasons. Probably the number one being that most systems do run down with age. The stomach has to put out a protein called intrinsic factor, and has to be functional. The intestinal tract at large has to be functional. B12, even if it's bound to the intrinsic factor from the stomach, has to have the right conditions at the tail end of the small bowel near the appendix. If the pH is not between 5 and 7, in other words, if it's too acid down there from undigested food or from a lactose intolerance or just from the wrong species of bacteria, dysbiosis, the B12 does not absorb, and that, in fact, as far as I can determine, that's the main reason why probiotics are important, to keep a consistent adapted state in the lower bowel by providing these lactobacilli that give a pH of about 5 rather than letting it get down to 3, where B12 will no longer absorb. So people are taking it, but they're not getting it because it just goes out at the tail end.
And this can be corrected with sauerkraut if you don't want to buy these pills that may have some milk in it, for those of you who are allergic.
Well, that's true. The sauerkraut, although sauerkraut is not a great source of B12, it is a great source of probiotics.
You can, yeah, for the probiotics.
And of TMG. Cabbages are high in, and the TMG, betaine, you know, that's, we put that in our Ololoa product in order to be able to bypass the such a common need for B12 that people aren't satisfying, that we have to have that second pathway. Thank heavens it's there, but even that is sometimes due to toxicity and mutation or zinc deficiency not working. And so it's not as easy as it looks. Mother Nature thought of almost everything. So B12 is important, that's what I'm saying. And not everybody's able to absorb it, and so you should talk to your doctor about getting a B12 injection, and if you respond to it, you should get another one, depending on how acutely ill you may or may not be. Next, if you're more ill, you take more B12. Until you may be surprised. About 2 months out, you're well. It could be every week, could be once a month. It's usually more than your doctor thinks to get the most results with B12. Yeah. And sometimes things respond if you go into heroic megadoses of B12. And that's where I began to realize, in fact, why we were having our little talk today on the air, Lena, is that it's our increased knowledge of B12 that justifies a new look at megavitamins. Because B12, the RDA is about 3/1,000,000 of a gram. It's 3 micrograms. Whereas we're using effectively up to 1,000 times that much. In fact, sometimes 10,000 times that much. I mean, that's mega dose without casualties. Quite the contrary, there are people who don't respond, don't heal until they get into those large areas of megavitamin happiness that we all look for. And we're not seeing casualties. Let me just remind you that. I'm looking for them because, after all, I don't want to play superior to Mother Nature. But on the other hand, you can't argue with results, and sick people need results or they just give up.
It's very important what you just said, because there's a lot of attacks on vitamin therapy, and it's very important, again, that you repeat it over and over again, where are the bodies? We're not seeing deaths from high doses of vitamins, so it's very rare. So
that's right, especially there's a lot of vitamins. Half of America is preferring at least to try megavitamins. And we should know with B12, one last thing, that all kinds of metals interfere with B12 at the enzyme level. So that we start with fluoride, which puts away folic acid to begin with. It oxidizes folate into an inactive form. Secondly, mercury. It's all over the place. We are being bombarded by air from China. Their coal-burning power plants are dumping mercury all over America. Trees don't grow in the Olympia Peninsula up there in Seattle right now.
You know what?
Et cetera. So there you are.
I have to go.
Okay,
I have that's to close it
point.
In.
We are
but that's very important.
Pollution.
Yes, and that is why we need the vitamins. So Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, if you want to find out about the yearly meeting, it's ohmsociety.com. If you want, and you press on future meetings, or you can go to ohmsocietysf@yahoo.com to send them an email. And
if they're lost, just call my office and our executive, Yadiga, will give it the
415-346-2500.
Exactly.
415-346-2500. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure.
Okay.
Lena. Bye-bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our book, our practice, our archive, our book signings, CD copies, lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness, produced by Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.